Hello, and welcome back to the Perspectives in History podcast. I'm your host, Willem Kahn. Thank you very much for listening, as always. This is part 9 of our series on the Korean War, The Stalemate. Well, everyone, I know in the last episode about 2 weeks ago, I said that I hope to get the next part out relatively soon, but it seems that I got a bit ahead of myself once again. Turns out I had a lot more to write about in this part than I originally thought, so my apologies for giving you all false hope. Now, an idea occurred to me recently that I'd like some input on. When I first made the release schedule for the 2023-2024 season a long time ago, I planned to release the final episode of the Korea series, Part 11, on April 6th. Obviously, we're much past that date by now, but the point is that I was going to release Part 1 of the next series 2 weeks afterwards, on April 27th. The series in question is about the Congo Free State, consists of 5 episodes total, meaning that the final part was scheduled to be released on June 22nd. The script for the series is already fully complete. Trust me, I made doubly sure this time that no major revisions were required. All that I have to do is record and edit the audio, which, while time-consuming, can be done on a schedule. My thought was that I can begin to release these new episodes starting in a week with the regular bi-weekly upload schedule, while I'd try to get the rest of the Korean War series released as I complete the script and are able to produce them, including the final 2 episodes and the reworked editions of the first 3. Now, this isn't something that I would normally do, and obviously I would have preferred it if I had been able to stick to the normal release schedule to begin with, but I feel like this might be a way for making it up to you, the listeners, for the significant delays in this current series. I still have not made up my mind as to whether this is what I want to do, so listener input would be greatly appreciated. Please send whatever thoughts you have on this matter to my email, perspectivesinhistory@gmail.com. The address will be written out in the episode's description as per usual. I will commit to this plan if I hear no strong objections in the next week or so. Anyway, that's quite enough housekeeping for now, so let's start the show. In the previous episode of this series on the Korean War, we discussed the events of the first few months of 1951. This was a critical period in the course of the war, where the fate of Korea still very much hung in the balance. With the UN forces still struggling to get back on their feet after the tumultuous final months of the previous year, they were unable to mount a strong defense of Seoul when the next phase of the Chinese offensive commenced on New Year's Day. But although they were forced to abandon the South Korean capital in favor of much stronger defensive positions in the south, the new commander of the 8th Army, General Matthew Ridgway, was no less determined to turn the tide once more. Beginning in the final week of January, Ridgway ordered a series of operations involving a slow and methodical advance north. This culminated in the recapture of Seoul on March 15th during Operation Ripper. The communists, meanwhile, were very much on the back foot. An abortive counteroffensive was undertaken in February to stem the tide of the UN advance, but resulted in 2 decisive defeats at the battles of Wonju and Chipyongni. In light of these most recent setbacks, the commander-in-chief of the Chinese People's Volunteer Army, General Peng Dehuai, went to Beijing to personally debrief with Chairman Mao Zedong. The general painted a bleak portrait of the war from his perspective. Enemy and airstrikes were wreaking havoc, the men were exhausted, hungry, and freezing, and of course there were the ever-present logistical problems. Peng's outlook on the war was not entirely pessimistic, though. In his estimation, Mao's hopes of a quick victory were not realistic as things currently stood. We also dedicated a fairly large part of the previous episode to a discussion of General Douglas MacArthur and his dismissal by President Harry Truman in April 1951. To make a long story short, MacArthur's ambition to widen the scope of the war in Korea put him at odds with his superiors in Washington, D.C., who, from the very beginning, had sought to keep the conflict contained within the Korean Peninsula. The UNC commander made a series of increasingly bellicose and defiant public statements on the matter until, in early April 1951, the decision was finally made to relieve him of his command. This action caused a great deal of controversy in the United States, as the sympathies of the American public were largely in favor of MacArthur. Calls went out for Truman's impeachment, and though this rage eventually subsided, MacArthur was not about to simply go quietly into retirement. In other words, this will not be the last time I have cause to discuss him in this series. And with that, let's return to the narrative. Following up on the success of Operation Ripper and the recapture of Seoul in the second week of March, the UN forces sought to maintain their forward momentum. A series of offensive operations undertaken the following month saw them advance steadily further north, pushing the communists back to the 30th parallel and even beyond it as far as 10 to 20 miles in some places. Despite their most recent string of defeats, including the failure of the fourth phase offensive and the subsequent loss of Seoul, Chairman Mao seemed to be no less confident in the communist prospect of victory. He was convinced that overwhelming numerical superiority would make the difference, and to that end, he ordered an additional 27 infantry divisions to Korea in early March. With the imminent arrival of 270,000 reinforcements, the communist total strength between the Chinese and North Koreans would be well over a million men. Enough, Mao believed, or at least hoped, to turn the tide once more. In a message to Stalin he wrote in early March, Mao indicated that he wished to launch the spring offensive in mid-May, thereby giving the reinforcing divisions sufficient time to get situated in the country. General Peng, meanwhile, was cautiously optimistic about their chances. To be sure, he continued to harbor concerns regarding the state of his army's logistics, especially when planning an operation on such a massive scale. But there were other considerations that convinced him of the urgent necessity for a new all-out offensive to the south. Peng feared that the enemy was planning another amphibious assault, similar to the Incheon operation. He could not allow the army to be outflanked and cut off from resupply and reinforcement, essentially repeating the same debacle of September 1950 all over again. It would be best to go on the attack now to disrupt these plans, and while the enemy was tired after having spent the last 3 months on the move. It was for these reasons that, despite his reservations, Peng sent a message to Mao asking for permission to begin the spring offensive ahead of schedule, in the final week of April rather than in mid-May. This was against the advice of his own subordinate generals, the most prominent of whom being his own deputy, Hong Xue-Xi. They favored a more cautious approach in line with the original plan, remaining on the defensive and gradually luring the enemy further north while they waited for their reinforcements. Their arguments did not sway Peng, and the affirmative response from Beijing put a definite end to this debate. The Chinese spring offensive began late in the afternoon of April 22nd. In what was the largest military operation of the entire war, 700,000 PVA and KPA soldiers attacked UN positions across the entire breadth of the front. The communist forces attacked in two major groupings, with the Chinese concentrating on breaking through enemy lines in the western and central sections of the country, while the North Koreans launched a smaller-scale attack in the east. The brunt of the initial Chinese attack fell on the ROK Army 6th Division, which was positioned near the town of Hwacheon, near the center of the country. Understrength, undertrained, and under-equipped, Allied units were unable to come to the aid of the South Koreans before they were forced to make a full retreat, thereby threatening to destabilize the entire front. General Ridgway was convinced that capturing Seoul was the enemy's primary objective, and that they hoped to accomplish this by means of an envelopment from the east. This time around, though, Ridgway was determined to hold on to the city rather than allowing it to change hands again. As he explained in his orders to the new commander of the 8th Army, General James Van Fleet, quote, "I attach considerable importance to the retention of Seoul. Now that we have it, it is of considerably more psychological value than its acquisition had been when we were south of the River Han." End quote. Van Fleet completely agreed with this assessment, writing himself, quote, "Seoul had been given up twice before. I thought that to give it up a third time would take the spirit out of the Korean nation. It would destroy their morale completely to lose their capital." End quote. Before going much further, I think it would be appropriate to provide some quick background information on Van Fleet, since he will play a fairly important role in the narrative going forward. James Van Fleet, aged 62 at the time of his assignment to the 8th Army, had a long career in the U.S. military, having served in both the First and Second World Wars. His most recent assignment had been as the director of the United States Joint Military and Planning Group in Greece. At the risk of going into too much detail, a civil war broke out in Greece in the immediate aftermath of World War II, when the broadly left-wing communist-dominated anti-Axis resistance group EAM-ELAS staged an uprising against the government of the Kingdom of Greece. In 1947, the United States assumed responsibility of providing the Greek government with economic and military assistance when the British, who previously led this effort, could no longer afford to do so. For the United States, this would be the first real test of the embryonic Truman Doctrine, which, as I outlined all the way back in the first episode of this series, was the geopolitical strategy aiming to halt the spread of Soviet influence worldwide. This, of course, was the rationale that had led to American intervention in Korea in the first place, and would shape U.S. foreign policy throughout the entire Cold War. At the time that Van Fleet first arrived in Greece in February 1948, the fighting was near the peak of its intensity. The communists were at the height of their success, and the Greek army's morale was at its lowest. Van Fleet was tasked with re-equipping, retraining, and reorganizing the Greek army into a modern and professional fighting force. It was thanks in large part to his efforts that the communist insurgents were mostly forced out of the country by August 1949. Truman, who once referred to Korea as the Greece of the Far East, had taken note of Van Fleet's success in the latter country and thought that he might be able to replicate it in the former. Although the juxtaposition of Greece and Korea may not seem to be the most obvious, there was a logic behind Truman's reasoning. In the following passage, historian Sheila Miyoshi Yeager offers her own assessment of the similarities between the two countries. Quote, "Both countries were poor and peninsular with mountainous terrain and racked by a brutal civil war with communists who were supported by border states, Yugoslavia in the case of Greece. The long-term solution for Korea, much like Greece, was thought to be the creation of reliable and effective indigenous security forces who could stand up to the communist threat," end quote. Van Fleet himself made it a priority to, quote, "do for the Republic of Korea Army the same as we did for the Greek divisions," end quote, although he couldn't begin this work immediately due to the exigencies of the war. In October 1951, at the request of President Syngman Rhee, Van Fleet helped re-establish the Korea Military Academy, which to this day remains the premier military academy in South Korea. It was for this accomplishment, among others, that Van Fleet would later be hailed as the father of the ROK Army. The long-term goal here was, in the words of a State Department memo, to, quote, "build up the ROK Army sufficiently to assume the major burden of UN operations in Korea," end quote. For the time being, though, it was clear that it would take much time and effort to achieve this goal, as the collapse of the ROK Army's 6th Division in the first days of the Spring Offensive demonstrated. Returning to the matter at hand, Chinese soldiers captured during these initial actions on April 22nd revealed that their commissars had told them that they would be marching through Seoul in a matter of days. They said that General Peng was dead set on delivering the South Korean capital as a gift to Mao for International Workers' Day, May 1st. General Ridgway, being well aware of the PVA's ongoing logistical issues, estimated that they would only be able to sustain their attack for a few days before they exhausted their supplies. The top priority for the UN, then, was to hold them off for just long enough for them to call off the offensive. This task would largely fall to the British 29th Infantry Brigade. The brigade, which consisted of three full British infantry battalions augmented by a tank regiment and an additional infantry battalion made up of Belgian and Luxembourgish troops, were assigned to defend a 12-mile stretch of territory along the lower Imjin River. As their location was just 25 miles directly north of Seoul, the 29th Infantry Brigade stood directly between the PVA and their objective. There were not enough troops to defend the area in a continuous line, and the large gaps between the units made the British vulnerable. The Chinese, on the other hand, brought overwhelming numbers, three entire divisions, 27,000 men in total, to bear against the enemy. When the attack began on the night of April 22nd, the Chinese exploited their enemy's weaknesses to great effect, sending large numbers of troops rushing through the gaps in their defenses, threatening to surround and cut off each of the individual battalions from each other. The British tried to stand their ground at first, but after 2 days of intense fighting, the brigade's commander, Brigadier Tom Brody, gave the order to retreat on the morning of April 25th. One of the four battalions, the 1st Battalion of the Gloucestershire Regiment, was pinned down on top of a hill and could not join the others right away. After a couple hours passed and it became clear that the other battalions were in no position to mount a rescue effort, the Gloucester's commander told his men that they could either try to surrender or fight their way back to the Allied lines. All present opted to make a fighting retreat, but very few of them made it off the battlefield alive. Only 77 of the battalion's initial strength of 699. 566 of the unit's 622 casualties were taken prisoner, while 56 were killed outright. The other battalions of the 29th Infantry Brigade fared a bit better, suffering only 469 casualties between them. The Battle of the Imjin River, as this engagement has become known, has gone down in history as the most famous battle fought primarily by British troops during the Korean War, with the actions of the Gloucester Regiment being especially lionized by British and Commonwealth historians. Upon receiving news of this battle, General Van Fleet lauded praise on the British troops, writing, quote, "This is one of those great occasions in combat that had called for a determined stand. The loss of 622 officers and men may well have saved many times that number," end quote. Indeed, the persistent defense put up by the Gloucesters and the rest of the brigade in general against unfavorable odds is credited with disrupting the PVA's forward momentum enough to the point that their offensive began to stall out. Before the month of April was even over, Peng was forced to admit defeat. In a dispatch to Beijing, he wrote, quote, "We have been unable to break open gaps for penetration into the enemy rear without engaging in bloody, costly battles," end quote. In the reply from Beijing, the general was granted permission to temporarily halt offensive operations. What followed was a lull in the action, which lasted 2 weeks. General Van Fleet remained wary of the enemy's intentions, as he later recalled, quote, "After we had turned back the enemy's first great onslaught by April 28th, we dug in and waited for him to come. We waited and waited and waited, and he still did not come," end quote. Van Fleet anticipated the PVA's next attack would, like the previous one, be concentrated primarily in the west. Intelligence reports in the second week of May indicated that enemy forces were gradually shifting eastward, leading Van Fleet to believe that the main route of their attack would be along the Bukhan River, which flows southwest from its headwaters near Mount Kumgang on the North Korean side of the border, until it converges with the Han River about 10 miles directly east of Seoul. With this in mind, Van Fleet repositioned his own forces accordingly, placing his strongest and most dependable units in the west-central sector near the Bukhan River. The PVA spring offensive resumed on May 16th at Chairman Mao's insistence. For the past 2 days leading up to this, rain and fog had impaired UN reconnaissance missions and obscured the enemy's movements. When the long-awaited resumption of the spring offensive finally came, the main focus of the communist attack was along the Soyang River, near the center of the UN line, much further to the east than Van Fleet had thought. The offensive initially met with some success, inflicting heavy losses on the ROK Army 1st and 3rd Corps, forcing the latter to rout from the field entirely. Further to the west, the U.S. Army 2nd Infantry Division put up a stronger defense, buying time for reinforcements to arrive and plug the gap that the ROK units left behind, before the PVA could push much further south. Once more, the Chinese and North Korean attacks stalled out as constant bombardment from UN artillery inflicted devastating losses. The 2nd Infantry Division's official combat history describes these scenes in vivid and somewhat vulgar detail. Quote, "Artillery crashing into the ground forward of the lines took a terrific toll on the attackers, while hundreds of others died in the minefields checkered with barbed wire. The groans of the wounded, screams of the attackers, and the blasts of bugles mingled with the clattering roar of battle as waves of Chinese pushed against the lines. Searchlights were turned on to illuminate the battle area, aiding defenders in locating and slaughtering the onrushing Chinese." End quote. Having halted the renewed offensive by May 19th, Van Fleet could sense that the enemy was vulnerable. Together with General Almond, the commander of the 10th Corps, the two quickly devised a plan for a counteroffensive that, if executed with the proper speed and precision, had the potential to completely cut off the communist lines of supply and communication and block their route of retreat across the entire front. Not allowing the enemy any chance to regroup, the UN counteroffensive began on May 20th. The following day, Peng was forced to reckon with the failure of his offensive. Some limited territorial gains had been made, but the main objective of the operation, the recapture of Seoul, had eluded them. And this had come at a high cost. Estimates regarding Chinese and North Korean losses during the spring offensive vary, but the median figure is somewhere between 85,000 and 110,000 casualties, which represents around 10% of the total combined force. Peng felt that he had no choice but to cut his losses and order a full retreat. He intended to withdraw his forces to positions just north of the 38th parallel. He was aware that this would effectively reverse all the territorial gains that they had made since the third phase offensive began on New Year's Day. It would be as though they had never crossed the parallel to begin with, the main difference, of course, being the loss of tens of thousands of fighting men. The strategy of the UN counteroffensive involved an initial attack in the west, followed by a delayed advance in the east, the intention being to lure enemy forces in the east into complacency before striking, as Van Fleet described, quote, "During the opening days, the UN forces made no resistance along the east or the coast. The Red soldier in that advance must have thought it to be a very easy war. However, on the third day, we launched a counterattack in the main area of battle, so that instead of being outflanked by the Reds who poured down from the mountains and roads east as far as 50 miles, we pinched them off and disposed of them at leisure," end quote. The UN counteroffensive had proved to be a huge success. The communist forces were pushed back against the entire front, as far as 50 miles in some places. But not everything had gone exactly according to plan. UN forces in the east were able to maintain consistent contact with the enemy and steadily push them further north, while in the west, the speed of the KPA and PVA's withdrawal outpaced the UN forces there, allowing the army's time to escape mostly intact. Van Fleet later recalled his frustration at this turn of events, quote, "The mission to which we had been assigned, to establish a defensive line across the peninsula, had been accomplished. And though we could have followed up with our successes and defeated the enemy, that was not the intention of Washington. We met the attack and routed the enemy. We had beaten him and could have destroyed his armies. Those days were the most vivid in my memory. Great days when all of the Eighth Army, and we thought America too, were inspired to win." End quote. As it would turn out, the slow pace of the UN advance was indeed a deliberate decision. Van Fleet was probably not the only one who felt like the politicians in Washington, D.C. were holding them back from capitalizing on their success. From the perspective of these officials, though, total victory in Korea was a pipe dream, no matter how close it may have seemed to the men on the ground. To begin with, there was no indication that the Chinese, or the North Koreans for that matter, were even contemplating surrender. If the UN forces once again tried to push all the way to the Yalu, the Chinese would certainly redouble their efforts to protect their border. As for the North Koreans, they seemed every bit as unlikely to accept defeat. Already, some 10,000 communist insurgents, a mixture of KPA remnants and South Korean dissidents, had been waging a guerrilla war far behind UN lines, primarily in the area around Jirisan in the southwest, as mentioned in Episode 4. There was little doubt that a similar situation would develop if an attempt was made to fully occupy the north. Then, of course, there was the question of the Soviets. After all, the USSR also shared a land border with Korea, and it seemed just as unlikely that they would be willing to tolerate such a large hostile force on their far eastern flank. Moreover, if the war did spill over into China, which was a real possibility, the Soviets were then treaty-bound to retaliate. In short, lessons had been learned from MacArthur's march to the Yalu the year prior. The opinion of the American government was that a ceasefire in Korea pending an agreement restoring the pre-war status quo was the most desirable course of action at this time. Acheson stated as much in an address to the Senate on June 7th. On June 25th, the anniversary of the outbreak of the war in Korea, President Truman restated this opinion. Quote, "We are ready to join in a peaceful settlement in Korea now, just as we always have been." End quote. Still, when the Soviet ambassador to the UN, Yakov Malik, indicated the willingness of his government to mediate armistice negotiations on June 23rd, many in the American camp remained skeptical of the communists' intentions. As it turned out, they were right to think this way. Of the three principal communist leaders involved in this conflict, that is to say, Stalin, Mao, and Kim, it appears that, as of the current moment, only Kim was possessed of a strong desire to conduct an immediate truce, something that he became increasingly anxious about as time went on. The string of reversals at the front had made the prospect of Korean unification, on terms favorable to Kim and the communists at least, look increasingly slim, and by this point, Kim seems to have favored an agreement that would have at least allowed him to remain in power in the North for the time being. Stalin was of a different mind on this matter. Although he'd instructed Ambassador Malik to publicly express the Soviets' desires to initiate armistice talks, Stalin's private correspondence with Mao reveals his true intentions. In one telegram dated June 5th, he wrote the following, quote, "I do not think you should try to conclude the war in Korea too hastily. My reasons are, first, a prolonged war affords the Chinese military opportunity to learn modern warfare on the battlefield. Secondly, you can destabilize the Truman administration and destroy the military reputation of the British-US forces." End quote. In any event, Stalin was in favor of continuing to fight during the negotiations. As for Mao, his attitude was more ambivalent, and he gave conflicting messages to the different parties involved. In his communications with Stalin and Kim, and with his commanders in Korea, Mao continued to speak in optimistic terms about their battlefield prospects going forward. Quote, "The position at the front in June will be such that our forces will be comparatively weaker than the enemy. In July, we will be stronger than in June, and in August we will be even stronger. We will be ready by that time to make a stronger blow to the enemy." End quote. At the same time, he made a number of outward indications that China was prepared to enter armistice negotiations. A brief issued by the Chinese Communist Party's Central Committee on July 3rd stated, quote, "Peace has been the very purpose of the People's Volunteer Army's participation in the anti-aggression war in Korea." End quote. Mao's seeming hesitancy to commit fully to a ceasefire was perhaps on account of the fact that China had committed over 1.5 million soldiers to the war in Korea, and that by agreeing to end hostilities on terms deemed unfavorable would result in a massive blow to the country's international prestige, and perhaps also endanger the stability of the communist regime. Ultimately, Mao decided that it would be best to wait for the Americans to make the first move. On June 29th, 1951, his patience paid off. That morning, General Ridgway, broadcasting from his headquarters in Tokyo, issued a statement addressed to the Commander-in-Chief of the Communist Forces in Korea, informing them that the United Nations Command was willing to meet to discuss an armistice. The message went on, stating that if this desire was mutual, he would name a representative and suggest a time and place. This message, translated into both Korean and Chinese, was played repeatedly through the following day over all available radio frequencies. An official reply, issued jointly by Kim Il-sung and Peng Dehuai, was broadcast from Beijing on the evening of July 1st. They agreed to meet with UN representatives to discuss an armistice. They put forward July 10th as a starting date, but they rejected the proposed meeting location, a Danish hospital ship in the harbor of Wonsan, on North Korea's eastern coast. Instead, they put forward the city of Kaesong. Located just south of the 38th parallel, Kaesong is a city with a long history, having once been the capital of the medieval kingdom of Goryeo. For this reason, the city, which was at that moment under communist control, held a great deal of symbolic importance for the North Koreans. The UNC may not have realized it at this time, and hoping to expedite the process, readily agreed to the counterproposal. The announcements of ensuing peace talks led to an upsurge of enthusiasm on both sides that an end to the fighting may be close at hand. Crucially, both sides thought that they held the advantage at the onset of negotiations. DPRK State Radio triumphantly declared that, quote, "the armed aggression of the United Nations forces has ended in failure," end quote, and characterized the Americans as being desperate for peace. General Ridgway, on the other hand, remarked that the communists had been all but defeated militarily, and that he was confident that, quote, "with skillful handling of the armistice talks, history may well record that communist aggression reached its highest watermark in Korea, and thereafter communism began to recede in Asia," end quote. As planned, the armistice talks began on July 10th. Alan Winnington, the British journalist from whom I've quoted a few times in past episodes, was one of only two Western journalists allowed to cover the proceedings. He offered the following description of the negotiation site, quote, "The antique walled city of Kaesong, capital of the Goryeo dynasty a millennium ago, lay in South Korean territory just below the 38th parallel, 35 miles northwest of Seoul until June 25th last year, when the Northern Army seized it in the war's first hours. As a venue for talks, the North Koreans have chosen an old tea house, a former restaurant whose tile roof corners turn upward, pagoda style," end quote. Predictably, the talks got off to a rocky start. The UN delegation quickly realized that agreeing to meet at Kaesong was a mistake. Far from being the neutral zone that it was supposed to be, it was essentially no more than a propaganda stage for the communists. The UN delegates were not allowed to forget for a second that they were technically in enemy territory. They were required to fly white flags of surrender as they approached the negotiation site, and once within, they were escorted every step of the way by heavily armed Chinese and North Korean soldiers. At the head of the UN delegation was Vice Admiral Charles Turner Joy, a veteran of the Second World War and the current commander of U.S. naval forces in the Far East. The delegation also included three other American officers and Major General Paik Sun-yup, commander of the ROK Army First Corps. Paik represented the South Korean government at these talks in a strictly observational capacity, since the Republic of Korea itself was not officially party to the negotiations. I will explain why in a bit. Admiral Joy's communist counterpart was General Nam Il, the KPA's chief of staff. A close confidant of Kim Il-sung, Nam Il was a Russian-born Korean and also a veteran of World War II, having served in the Red Army during the Battle of Stalingrad and the Battle of Berlin. Impressive though as these credentials may have been, Nam's position as the head of the communist delegation was nominal. Throughout the negotiations, he and the other North Korean delegates would play a subordinate role to the Chinese, who themselves had two delegates present, PVA Deputy Commander Deng Hua and PVA Chief of Staff Xi Feng. These two communicated regularly with Lee Kenong, the Vice Foreign Minister of the PRC, and Xiao Guanhua, the head of the International Information Bureau of the Foreign Ministry, who formed an informal liaison group. These two sent detailed reports of the proceedings to Mao Zedong on a regular basis, who effectively directed the negotiations from Beijing, while still consulting with Stalin on most matters. Almost immediately, disagreements arose regarding incidental details, for instance, the constant presence of armed guards in the negotiating room, or the standing ban on Western journalists from entering the neutral zone. These disputes prevented an agenda from being set and delayed the proceedings for two whole days. Then, on July 12th, the UN delegation walked out in protest. They returned 3 days later, only after having extracted a promise from the communists to withdraw most armed personnel save for police from the neutral zone. With these issues now settled, the discussion could finally move on to the matters at hand. The UN delegation recommended an agenda consisting of three main items: the establishment of a truce line, the exchange of prisoners of war, and the creation of an international body to enforce the terms of any future agreement. The Communists thought these items were generally acceptable, but they proposed one further item, the complete withdrawal of all foreign troops from Korea. The UN delegation outright refused to entertain such a proposal, leading the Communists to drop the idea entirely. By the 26th, both sides had reached an agreement on the agenda, and discussion regarding the first item, the establishment of a truce line, began. Once again, there was immediate disagreement. The Communists' initial position was that the armistice line should correspond to the 38th parallel. Seeing as how this would just restore the pre-war boundary between North and South Korea, this arrangement seems reasonable at first glance. But UN negotiators saw things differently. At this time, most of the front east of Seoul lay significantly north of the 38th parallel. The UN held a significant amount of territory, 4,600 square miles to be precise, north of the pre-war border, territory that they would have to relinquish if the Communists had their way in this regard. Because of the strategic value of this territory, Ridgway was adamant that this did not happen. Thus, Admiral Joy rejected the proposal on the basis that, quote, the 38th parallel has no significance to the currently existing military situation, end quote. General Nam was furious, lambasting Joy's arguments as naive and illogical, and questioning the UN's true motives, quote, seeing as how you make such a completely absurd and arrogant statement, for what reason have you actually come here? Have you come here to negotiate for peace, or just to look for an excuse to extend the war? End quote. In response, Joy sternly lectured his North Korean counterpart, quote, those peoples whose military organizations are respected throughout the world are proud of their reputation for courtesy and for objective mental attitudes. Military men are expected to be sufficiently mature to realize that bluster and bombast, phrased in such intemperate language, do not and cannot affect the facts of any military situation. Rudeness, such as you have just displayed, will lead the delegation of the United Nations Command to conclude that you have no serious or sincere purpose at this conference. End quote. On learning of this heated exchange at Kaesong, Ridgway offered his reassurances to the UN delegates that they were simply, quote, experiencing the ancient Oriental custom of doggedness in negotiations. Firmness and patience are the only effective countermeasures. End quote. But while Joy's reprimand did make Nam tone down his rhetoric, for the time being at least, it did not induce him to back down from his position. And so, the negotiations became deadlocked, with neither side willing to make a substantive compromise. This was the state of affairs for about a month until, on August 23rd, the Communists then abruptly announced that they would be suspending the talks indefinitely. They alleged that the night before, a plane had attacked the neutral zone, strafing and dropping bombs near the Chinese delegation's living quarters. No one was seriously injured or killed, and the Americans denied responsibility. This incident occurred only a few days after an armed raid on the neutral zone resulted in the death of a Chinese military policeman and the wounding of another. It was initially unclear what party was to blame for the attack. A subsequent investigation led the Americans to conclude that the perpetrators, who eyewitnesses allege were dressed in civilian clothing, were South Korean partisans who staged the attack to deliberately sabotage the armistice negotiations. In this case as well, the Americans denied any involvement, but Mao claimed to find their explanation wanting, as he wrote in a message to Stalin, quote, the enemy, in justifying himself, stated that this attack was committed by South Korean partisans, and therefore he does not take any responsibility for it. The negotiations will not be resumed until we have received a satisfactory answer, end quote. It is unlikely that the UNC was involved in the attack in any way, but whether the attackers were acting on their own initiative or on orders from Syngman Rhee or anyone else in the ROK government remained an unsolved question. The motive is entirely plausible. As Wada Haruki points out in The Korean War and International History, the fact that the Chinese and Americans had co-opted this conflict, turning what had essentially been a Korean civil war into a wider geopolitical struggle, did not mean that the Koreans stopped thinking of the war in those terms. In other words, quote, the leaders of both North and South Korea passionately believed that a military stalemate meant that all the sacrifices the Korean people had made would be for nothing, end quote. President Rhee said as much outright in a statement to the press given in July before the negotiations began, quote, our people have died, been killed. Their homes were destroyed and cities ruined. Boys of friendly nations have sacrificed their lives. We didn't do it all for nothing. End quote. In a letter to Ridgway dated July 20th, the South Korean president elaborated on his government's stance vis-a-vis reunification. Quote, our position is that we cannot maintain our nation in half of our country. A divided Korea is a ruined Korea, unstable economically, politically, and militarily. The fact is clear to us that the Korean nation must be committed to the simple but vital principle of reunification. Maintenance of the division between North and South could only be at the sufferance of, and through direct support by, foreign powers. Korea must in effect either cease to be an independent entity, or it must become all one body, fully democratic or fully communist. End quote. In a conversation with the American ambassador to South Korea, John Muchio, Ri clarified that these views were shared by all Koreans in both North and South. If this statement is accurate, and I believe it is, it raises an important question. Why did the South Koreans openly express their opposition to the armistice talks and go so far as to attempt to sabotage the proceedings, while the North Koreans, on the other hand, actively participated in the negotiations? What accounts for these drastically different approaches to the issue if they both desired reunification? These are questions without very straightforward answers. For one, it appears that the North and South Korean leadership had different notions of what a ceasefire would entail and what its ramifications might be. According to Haruki, Kim Il-sung had been apprehensive about entering armistice negotiations at first, but was persuaded by Stalin during a state visit to Moscow in early June. Haruki reconstructs the agenda of that meeting from the memoirs of Kim's interpreter. Quote, after briefing him on the military situation in Korea, Stalin asked the visitors which option they preferred, to seek an immediate ceasefire or to continue to fight until the situation on the front lines improved before opening negotiations. The response from Kim was unclear. He used various expressions such as stop the fighting, ceasefire, peace, reconciliation, armistice, and peace treaty. Stalin explained what each of these terms actually meant and inquired further as to his intentions. When Kim said that he wanted a ceasefire, Stalin explained that it was merely a suspension of military activity for a fairly long period. The two sides could negotiate, but the war was not over and the fighting could resume at any time. A ceasefire was not peace, he told them. End quote. Essentially, Kim had been led to believe that any suspension of hostilities that would result from the negotiations at Kaesong would ultimately be temporary. In a radio address on August 14th, the chairman explained the reason why North Korea had agreed to participate in the talks. Quote, whatever the intention of the American imperialists in asking for a ceasefire, when a person who has broken the peace says that he wants to resolve the problem peacefully, there is no reason why we, who have proposed a peaceful solution to the Korean problem, still desire it, and will continue to advocate for it, should not respond positively. Furthermore, we did not attack America. The American imperialists crossed the Pacific Ocean to subjugate Korea. They failed, and now they say they want to stop the war. There is no reason why the Koreans, as a peace-loving people, cannot agree to an offer to halt the war. The Korean people desire armistice talks. The Korean people have always wanted peace, and we seek peace now. End quote. Syngman Rhee and the Southern leadership's interpretation of the situation was quite different. Rhee thought that a cessation of hostilities, however temporary, could only allow for the communists to entrench their positions and thereby prolong the division of the country. On July 16th, Ambassador Muchio wrote a report detailing his discussions with the president. Quote, Rhee warned that a ceasefire would be used by the Russians for propaganda, and commies everywhere would believe that they were the victors and that the U.S. had sued for peace. The Soviets' goal was to eject the U.S. from South Korea, and he saw no possibility of ever inducing the Soviets to get out of the North. Thus, if Korea was ever to be unified, short of a Third World War, it must be done now and by military means. Ri insisted that the Koreans desired to reunite at any cost and to obliterate any memory of the 38th parallel. He said that by signing a ceasefire agreement, the UN would only be appeasing the commies, and World War III could never be avoided that way. End quote. The differing approaches of the leaders of North and South Korea to the armistice negotiations may also be explained by their relationships to their respective foreign backers. The prospect of a perpetually divided Korea anguished Kim Il-sung just as much as it did his southern counterpart, but at this juncture he felt he had very little to say in the matter. He and the rest of the North Korean leadership had been effectively sidelined by the Chinese in matters both military and diplomatic. Kim, it appeared, was unwilling to risk a break with China by openly challenging their leadership in either regard. Ri, on the other hand, had no similar compunctions about defying the United States. His opposition to any sort of agreement with the communists led him not only to refuse to participate in the negotiations, but to actively work to sabotage them. No one in the South Korean government ever took responsibility for the partisan raid on the neutral zone, but it's certainly plausible that the attackers had received orders from higher up. Furthermore, as we'll see in the future, Ri was not above resorting to less than scrupulous measures to get his way, even if it meant double-crossing his benefactors. One should make no mistake, however, South Korea was every bit as dependent on foreign support as North Korea, perhaps even more so. But according to General Van Fleet, there were substantial rumors to the effect that, quote, the ROK Army was prepared in the event of any settlement along the 38th parallel to continue the fighting regardless of the consequences, end quote. Van Fleet brought this to Ridgway's attention, who passed the info along to Truman. Truman, in turn, sent a message to Rhee, warning him that, quote, it is of the utmost importance that your government takes no unilateral action which might jeopardize the armistice discussions, end quote. He further intimated that if Rhee continued to interfere with the negotiation process, that the UN forces were prepared to make a complete withdrawal, leaving the South Koreans to fend for themselves. Truman's threat did induce Rhee to back down, but only for the time being. As we'll see, this will not be his last attempt to prolong the war. In any event, after the talks were suspended in late August, they remained suspended for the better part of 2 months. In July, Ridgway had instructed the UN delegation at Kaesong to reject a communist proposal to implement a temporary ceasefire while talks were ongoing. As I mentioned previously, UN forces currently held a significant amount of territory north of the 38th parallel. Part of the reason why they would not consider reinstating the parallel as an armistice line is because the current battlefront was more defensible for them than the old border had been. Although the front had not moved very much since the UN counteroffensive halted at the beginning of July, Ridgway felt that they still held the initiative. When it became clear that talks were going nowhere, UN forces engaged in small-scale attacks intended to improve their positions in specific locations across the front. In this period, from mid-August until mid-October, when the negotiations recommenced, some of the deadliest battles of the war took place, namely the Battle of Bloody Ridge, the Battle of the Punch Bowl, and the Battle of Heartbreak Ridge. Now, I don't intend to describe the specific contours of each of these engagements in great detail, since I don't think that would be the best use of our time here. Rather, I'll attempt to convey a general sense of what these battles and many of the subsequent ground battles throughout the stalemate were like. Authors trying to describe this phase of the war tend to make comparisons to the Western Front of World War I. Now, of course, this isn't a perfect one-to-one analogy. Technology had advanced significantly since 1914, and the hills of Korea were a lot different from the fields of Flanders. But still, the comparison is a helpful one. The opposing armies fought bitterly against each other over relatively small bits of territory, with hundreds, even thousands of men falling in battle only to take a single hill or ridge. In Chapter 30 of This Kind of War, Fehrenbach provides an outlook on the strategic situation, as well as some insights into the thoughts of the men in the trenches from the American perspective. Quote, their new orders always seem to read, fight on, but don't fight too hard. Don't lose, but don't win either. Just hold the line while the diplomats muddle through. These directives were desperately hard for men brought up to take positive action and quickly, even if they were in the wrong. But it was harder still for the riflemen and the tankers and weapon squads dug in along the scarred, dirty hills. Now they knew less than ever why they dug into their holes or why they died. Hoping for the war to end at any moment, they always kept one eye on Kaesong. When they were ordered to defend one hill or to take another, they knew the action was a limited one, and they knew no matter what brave words were said, such actions would probably not affect the outcome of the war. No man wants to give up his life for some inconsequential reason, and there is no honor, only irony, in being the last man killed in a war. When the advance stopped in June, it had not been along any pre-planned battle line. There were bulges, salients, and vague areas of no man's land across the entire front. From a military standpoint, corrections were needed. In many places, the 8th Army held disadvantageous ground. And as the talks dragged on at Kaesong, the UN command became more and more convinced that the enemy was stalling. They agreed that pressure, judiciously applied, might have a desirable effect. The attacks would be limited in zone for limited objectives, a hill there to erase a bulge there to deny enemy observation in another place. These attacks would serve two other purposes, to pressure the enemy into sincerity at the peace conference and to keep the army on its toes. It was not an ambitious program or an unreasonable one in the situation. Policy was guided by restraint, and it was limited. The only thing that would not be limited were the casualties. End quote. While the UN forces continued to engage in small-scale offensive operations like the kind just described, the ceaseless bombardment from the air forced their communist adversaries to adopt a more defensive stance. They began to construct an elaborate network of tunnels, bunkers, and trenches deep in the hills and mountains across the front. In Ghost Flames, Hanley describes the shift in strategic thinking that the Chinese military leadership had at this time. Quote, Peng Dehuai's army has been building an underground Great Wall since late summer, after a pivotal meeting in Beijing of the Communist Party's Central Committee to decide war strategy. Since the failure of the spring offensive, and save for the occasional large-scale battle like that at Heartbreak Ridge, a stalemate has taken hold across the front, but it is a bloody one, a war fought in trenches over small bits of ground. General Peng tells his generals that they will plan no major offensives through the rest of the year, unless unexpected circumstances require them to do so. Instead, they adopt a strategy that Mao calls small bites, tactics of attrition. Ambushes, overwhelming but narrow attacks to inflict heavy casualties on an enemy platoon, constant sniper fire to kill off enemy soldiers one by one. To do so, they must be able to withdraw to a strong, secure base, their new Great Wall. End quote. Since they lacked any heavy machinery, these new fortifications had to be constructed by manual labor. This became an all-out effort, with one PVA general writing that, quote, each soldier carried a rifle in one hand and a shovel in the other, end quote. Yang Diji, of the PVA's 15th Army Group, later recalled some of the difficulties involved. Quote, the big orchestra composed of our soldiers and commanders played a new movement in constructing tunnel fortifications. This approach meant operating inside the mountains, dealing with rocks, sand, grit, and the odd cave-in. Lacking technology or any advanced tools, we depended largely on our own hands. Pickaxes were worn down to the point where they ended up looking like rounded iron blocks in the shape of a hammer. Rocks and broken earth were hauled away in ox carts. Broken glass and metal plaques were used at tunnel entrances to reflect sunshine inside during the daytime. At night, we burned pine resin or fashioned oil lamps from shell casings. The men worked so hard that their palms blistered. End quote. Thanks to this hard work, by August 1952, the Chinese had constructed 125 miles of tunnels and 400 miles of trenches. By the end of the war, there were 4,000 miles of trenches and 800 of tunnels. These constructions formed highly intricate and labyrinthine networks that some observers characterize as underground cities. Entire units were practically able to live underground full-time, with all the necessary facilities, sleeping quarters, mess halls, command centers, latrines, armories, and so on. Needless to say that these extensive new defenses made it quite difficult for the enemy to take and hold positions above ground, and made the communist position on the front lines highly secure. But there were significant drawbacks as well. So much time spent underground led to poor sanitation, which inevitably caused health issues. Lack of sunlight and nutrition only made matters worse, and caused some soldiers to go blind. Supply shortages, especially of food and drinking water, also continued to cause problems. And of course, the ceaseless bombing above ground sometimes caused portions of the tunnels to cave in, burying men alive. Still, by adapting to conditions in this way, the communists had found a way to mitigate the losses that would have been inflicted on them by the bombing campaigns on the surface. Speaking of which, this period, specifically August 1951, saw a new phase open in the air war. Codenamed Operation Strangle, this was an escalation of the UNC's ongoing interdiction campaign against strategic targets in North Korea. The US Air Command conceived of this operation as a more methodical and sustained attempt to cut off the communist supply routes by targeting roads and railroads. The underlying rationale was to put greater pressure on the communists to reopen the armistice negotiations and, ideally, to conclude them quickly. The UNC diverted 3/4 of all available bombers to this operation, indicating that they placed a high priority on it. However, by June 1952, it had become painfully obvious that 10 months of sustained bombing had not at all produced the intended result. The communists were still managing to get their supplies to the front, and all the UNC had to show for it was 343 aircraft destroyed and 290 critically damaged. As it turned out, the North Koreans were able to adapt to these new conditions rather effectively. To be sure, the UN forces could bomb railways and bridges and destroy them, but the tireless efforts of conscripted civilian laborers could repair such damages in a remarkably short time. At the same time, the North Koreans' capacity to defend against hostile aircraft was constantly improving as they received more and more anti-aircraft guns from the USSR as time went on. They placed most of these AA guns along railroads and concentrated them specifically around high-priority targets such as bridges, warehouses, and important rail junctions, and managed to inflict heavy casualties on UNC aircraft as a result. The communists were also able to mount a significant challenge to the UN's air superiority thanks to their new secret weapon, the Mikoyan Gurevich MiG-15. Usually simply referred to as the MiG-15, this was a state-of-the-art fighter aircraft of Soviet design and manufacture. It was equipped with an advanced jet engine that allowed it to reach higher speeds and altitudes than nearly any other aircraft widely in use at that time. As early as September 1950, the Soviets agreed to supply the North Koreans with MiG-15s and to train their pilots how to use them. The near-total destruction of the North Korean Air Force earlier in the war meant that they would have to create an entirely new Air Force, essentially from square one. New pilots, usually with no prior flight experience to speak of, had to be recruited and sent to Manchuria for training. This would be no quick or easy process. In fact, it would be about a year before the first cadre of North Korean pilots were deemed to be combat ready. Shortly after the People's Volunteer Army crossed the border into Korea in October 1950, the Soviets decided to commit an entire corps of the Soviet Air Force, about 26,000 personnel at its peak, and approximately 950 MiG-15s, to aerial combat operations in Korea. Although he was willing to make such a significant contribution of manpower and material, Stalin was apprehensive about how the United States and its allies would react to the Soviets having taken an active role in the Korean conflict. He evinced these concerns in a meeting with the Chinese delegation in mid-October. Quote, "It would be difficult for us to send troops there again. It would be tantamount to a state of war with the U.S. We can provide weapons and equipment and, at a strategic time, a certain number of aircraft. Of course, the cover they will be able to provide will be limited to rear areas on this side of the battlefield. We cannot go into enemy rear areas, and we must avoid having aircraft being shot down or pilots being taken prisoner by the enemy. Soviet pilots becoming prisoners of war would have a bad effect internationally." End quote. In order to maintain the USSR's appearance as a neutral party in the conflict, efforts were made to conceal their involvement. Soviet pilots were prohibited from flying within 50 to 80 kilometers of UN positions and never south of Pyongyang or over the open ocean. Their planes were repainted with markings of the People's Liberation Army Air Force, and their pilots wore Chinese-style uniforms. They were also instructed to communicate in Korean over the radio, for fear that the enemy would intercept their transmissions, but it was nearly impossible to keep up this facade in the heat of battle. Based on analysis of enemy radio communications, American intelligence suspected that 90% of MiG pilots were Russian. For decades afterwards, the Soviet government continued to deny any of its military personnel were directly involved in combat operations in Korea. It was not until the collapse of the USSR in the 1990s that these long-held suspicions were finally confirmed when the pilots themselves spoke out. For the most part, Soviet MiG pilots who saw action in Korea were veterans of World War II and as such were highly experienced. In fact, several American pilots remarked on the surprising ability demonstrated by their adversaries. The first MiG-15s appeared in the skies over Northwest Korea on November 1, 1950. Very soon after their first encounters with the U.S. Air Force, it was made apparent that the latter were outclassed. Most USAF aircraft in Korea, at least up to this point, had been World War II-era propeller-based piston-engine models like the P-51 Mustang and the F-4U Corsair. Fighter aircraft like these were easily outmaneuvered by the MiGs. Even the jet fighters that were already in use, such as the F-80 Shooting Star, were unable to contend. Slow-moving bombers like the B-29 Super Fortress were especially vulnerable to attack. According to official Air Force records, between 34 and 57 B-29s were lost in combat, including at least 16 shot down by MiGs. Most of these losses occurred between November 1950 and April 1951, after which point the U.S. stopped daytime bombing raids altogether. The heretofore complacent U.S. Air Command was greatly alarmed by the emergence of this formidable new weapon. To counter the threat posed by the MiG-15, the U.S. Air Force dispatched multiple squadrons of its newest jet fighter, the F-86 Sabre, to Korea. The MiG-15 was slightly faster and more maneuverable than the Sabre, but the two were more or less evenly matched. Once the Sabre was introduced, dogfights between the MiGs and the Sabres became commonplace. The restrictions on the MiG pilots meant that they only operated in a geographically small region in the far northwestern corner of Korea that American pilots began to refer to as MiG Alley. American pilots operated under similarly limited rules of engagement, as they were expressly forbidden from entering Chinese airspace. The Communists took full advantage of this by operating out of airbases in Manchuria, with the main base being located at Andong, just across the Yalu River. Unable to pursue their enemy, American pilots balked at this restriction, and General MacArthur asked the President and Joint Chiefs of Staff several times for it to be lifted, to no avail. The battles over MiG Alley continued right up until the very end of the war, and reached the peak of their intensity between November 1951 and January 1952. Naturally, one might be inclined to ask who won the battle for Mig Alley, and the answer would be that it was inconclusive. People tend to make a lot out of the statistics involved, especially the win-to-loss ratio of the respective sides. Unfortunately, both sides involved had a tendency to downplay their own losses while exaggerating those of the enemy, even in official documents not intended to be seen by the public. For instance, the U.S. Air Force officially claims a 14-to-1 kill-loss ratio in favor of the F-86 Sabre. The Soviets, meanwhile, claim a ratio anywhere between 5-to-1 and 8-to-1 in their own favor. Over the years, historians have done quite a bit of archival research to arrive at more believable figures, and according to the most recent scholarship, the actual ratio for the Sabre was probably closer to 2-to-1, although the particular study that is most often cited only takes into account the Sabre's record versus the MiG, and does not factor in any of the other planes that the MiGs engaged in combat with during the war. Now, I will say it's not my intention to dedicate an inordinate amount of time to this discussion of which plane was better or anything like that. To return to the bigger picture, it's worth pointing out that jet versus jet dogfights constitute a relatively small percentage, about 12% of all aerial operations in Korea. And yet, these engagements feature prominently in the popular memory of the Korean War, at least in the West, and are the focus of several books and films. There is a somewhat straightforward explanation for this, I believe. This style of combat, one-to-one duels high in the air between more or less evenly matched opponents, has a certain romantic appeal to it, especially when contrasted with the more sordid and ignoble realities of the war on the ground below. Fighter pilots were like the medieval knights of their day, widely admired for their skill, courage, heroism, and so on. Their exploits were celebrated by the media in their respective countries, especially the aces, those pilots who claimed at least 5 victories. The Korean War produced dozens of these flying aces, with 40 American pilots, 9 Chinese, 4 North Koreans, and at least 52 Soviets all claiming the status. Now, although I did say that this particular aspect of the war is the subject of a disproportionate amount of attention in my opinion, I would be remiss in my duties as a historian if I did not try to convey a sense of how the pilots themselves experienced these actions. So, with that in mind, the passages I'm about to read come from Hanley's Ghost Flames. They center on a North Korean fighter pilot named No Kum-suk and are adapted from a memoir that he wrote in 1996. At the risk of getting a bit off topic, No's story is quite interesting and merits a brief retelling here, since I don't think I'll have cause to bring him up again going forward. A native of Hamhung, North Korea, No Kum-suk was 18 years old when the Korean War first broke out. At that time, he was a cadet in the North Korean Navy, but in September 1950, he passed a series of aptitude tests being given to prospective pilots and was subsequently sent to Manchuria for training. After about a year of instruction by Soviet pilots, No was promoted to senior lieutenant and began flying combat missions in November 1951. The following account is of one such mission that took place on January 25th, 1952, around the height of the battle for Mig Alley. Quote, "On this morning, before taking off on their daily combat mission, the MiG battalion commander joked that if he met an American pilot as inexperienced as his young Lieutenant No Kum-suk, he would eat him alive. Now, Major Pak, Lieutenant No, and the rest of their formation of 24 North Korean jet interceptors are flying into the combat zone on the lookout for enemy Sabre jets. They're at 26,000 feet, an unusually low altitude for entering North Korean airspace. For months, the American F-86 Sabres and the MiG-15s, flown mostly by Russian and Chinese pilots, have dueled to a standoff over this corner of North Korea. However, the duels above Mig Alley appear to be entering a new phase. The MiG pilots and the Americans are growing more aware of the Soviet-built fighter's drawbacks. Although it can climb faster than the Sabre, the US-built jet can dive faster. The MiG's cannon, slower firing and harder to aim, are inferior to the Sabre's machine guns in a dogfight. Because the low-grade Soviet fuel leaves a long, telltale trail, the MiG can be spotted from 100 miles away, and MiG pilots have poor rear visibility. This morning, the American pilots have spotted their enemy before he spotted them. No Kum-suk's 24-plane mission has strayed blindly into a formation of Sabres. The mission commander immediately orders his jets to climb, but it's too late. In his headphones, No can hear the rattle of Sabre machine guns. Two of the Americans, lurking above and behind them, are diving at supersonic speeds through the Koreans' formation, guns blazing. No sees 3 MiGs plummet to fiery deaths. Only one parachute opens. Among the fallen is Major Pak, the joking battalion commander. No and the others, scattered and disorganized, turn hurriedly for home. No now realizes that the higher command should have instructed them to gain higher altitude before entering Mig Alley. The ineptitude of their superiors have cost them 3 aircraft and the lives of 2 pilots. Such dueling plays out daily in the thin, icy air miles above northwestern Korea. No Kumsok, recently turned 20, is at the flight line every morning at 5:45 sharp, awaiting the signal to run to his plane, to take off and climb towards the stratosphere in his freezing cockpit, ever fearful that this might be the day that he doesn't return. And, as the Americans introduced faster and deadlier versions of the F-86, and Soviet pilots begin to field new and improved MiG-15Bs, more than ever, it becomes a duel of technological advancement and production capacity, as much as a test of pilots' skills. End quote. The next account took place sometime later, likely in late February of the same year. Quote, at 40,000 feet, far above the jagged mountains east of Pyongyang, a radioed alert comes in from their controllers. Sabers are in the area. No Kumsok and his fellow pilots on the combat mission scan the skies. They see only other MiG-15s. Suddenly, tracer bullets streak past. They're under attack from behind by 4 F-86 Sabers. No banks his jet sharply to the right, pointing his nose north towards home, but a stream of bright red tracers follows him, flashing over his canopy. He twists his head around. A Saber is tailing him, at his altitude half a mile behind. He throttles forward and pulls back on his stick, summoning the MiG's 5,000 pounds of thrust to climb. In a cold panic, he swings the stick back and forth, pounds on the rudder pedals, swerving his sleek, silvery jet to the left and to the right, dodging machine gun fire as he ascends. The glowing tracers follow, above and to the side, but not hitting him. Long minutes pass until No finally looks back, seeing the Saber growing smaller and smaller in the distance, no longer firing and unable to match his climb. A sense of relief overwhelms the terrified No Kumsok. He has survived his closest call to date. For months, every day, sometimes twice a day, No and his comrades take off into the skies over Manchuria and turn south into North Korea to hunt F-86s, as the Sabers, in turn, hunt them. Most days, 100 MiGs rise into the miles-high combat zone, and No estimates that on average, one is shot down per day. Usually it's a Russian pilot since they're the most daring, but on some days it's many more on both sides. End quote. The two missions just recounted were just 2 of the 300 that Lieutenant No claimed to have participated in through the course of the war. On September 21st, 1953, 2 months after the armistice went into effect, No defected to the south, flying his MiG-15 to Kimpo Air Base just west of Seoul. When he was taken into custody and interrogated by the American authorities, he claimed his decision to defect was ideologically motivated and that he was unaware that the American government had offered to pay $100,000 to the first enemy pilot to defect and deliver a fully intact MiG-15 into their custody. In addition to the substantial monetary reward, No was granted asylum in the United States and became an American citizen the following year. Anyway, I've said about all I have to say on that particular subject for the time being. Now, we should return to the diplomatic side of things. In early August, as the negotiations at Kaesong began to break down, General Matthew Ridgway sent a telegram to his superiors in Washington, D.C., expressing his intense frustration with the communist behavior at the negotiating table. Quote, "These are discussions between soldiers. One half of them are communists who only understand what they want to understand, who consider courtesy a concession and concessions as weakness, who are uninhibited in repudiating their own solemn obligations, who view such obligations solely as a means to an end, who attained power through murderous conspiracy, and who remain in power through similar means. To sit down with these men and to deal with them as though they are representatives of some enlightened or civilized people is to deride one's own dignity and to invite the disaster that their treachery will inevitably bring upon us. I propose to direct the UN delegation to govern its utterances accordingly and while remaining, as they have, scrupulously factual and properly temperate in word and deed, to employ such language and methods as these treacherous savages cannot fail to understand." End quote. After the communist delegation broke off the talks entirely a few weeks later, Ridgway came under a great deal of pressure, not only from his superiors but from America's foreign allies, to get the communists back to the negotiating table. While he wasn't necessarily opposed to this, he firmly insisted that the venue for the talks be moved elsewhere. Not only was Kaesong not a truly neutral site, but as the events of August had demonstrated, the site was not fully secure either. In late September, UN officials proposed an alternative meeting location, Panmunjom, a small village about 10 kilometers east of Kaesong. In fact, referring to it as a village might be somewhat of an overstatement. At that time, Panmunjom consisted of a handful of wood huts along a dirt road. Needless to say, it was a far less impressive venue than Kaesong, but since it was located in the no man's land between the two opposing forces, it was considered a genuinely neutral location. The communists, though initially reluctant, eventually agreed to relocate to Panmunjom, and so it was here, in a collection of hastily erected tents, that the negotiations resumed on October 25th. At Panmunjom, the issue of the truce line was once more at the forefront of the agenda. The UNC maintained their previous stance on the issue, that the truce line should mostly correspond with the already existing battle lines. However, this time they went further, demanding that Kaesong, which again was in South Korean territory prior to the war, should be returned to the ROK's jurisdiction. Rather than have negotiations stall out again, the communists agreed to recognize a truce line along the current front, effectively dropping their demand that the pre-war boundary be restored while getting to hold on to Kaesong. The UN delegation saw this as a major concession and would have accepted right away had the communists not made this offer conditional on the enactment of an immediate ceasefire for the duration of the talks. Just as they had before, the UN delegation rejected this proposal on the basis that the suspension of hostilities would prevent the UN from being able to apply military pressure, and thereby allowing the communists to prolong the negotiations regarding the remaining agenda items indefinitely. By refusing to implement even a temporary ceasefire, Ridgway was again resisting immense pressure from back home and abroad to bring the fighting to an end as quickly as possible. An opinion poll conducted in the United States showed that 67% of Americans agreed that the war in Korea was utterly useless, to use the question's exact phrasing. Senator Robert Taft of Ohio voiced similar statements in a session of Congress, quote, "A stalemated peace is better than a stalemated war. We had better curtail our losses of 2,000 casualties a week in a war that cannot accomplish anything," end quote. The United States partners in the UN coalition, especially the British, were growing increasingly frustrated with what they perceived as American intransigence. The communists eventually dropped their demand for an immediate ceasefire, and the two sides finalized an agreement on the truce line by the end of November, thus allowing them to proceed to the next item on the agenda, the prisoners of war. As it would turn out, this issue would prove even more thorny than the last one. As author Max Hastings posits in his 1987 book, quote, "No single aspect of the Korean conflict caused greater bitterness, bordering on hysteria, than the POW issue," end quote. In the final portion of this episode, and in the course of the entire next episode of this series, we will delve into this complicated and controversial topic. As the talks proceeded to the next agenda item, the UN delegation's opening move was to request an exchange of POW rosters, as, at that time, neither side had precise knowledge of the identities or even the number of their personnel held prisoner by the other. The UN's initial estimate suggested that they held about 150,000 prisoners, while the communists held about 10,000, potentially less. The delegates' instructions from Washington, D.C. stated that they should seek to arrange an all-for-all exchange of POWs. This would have been in compliance with the Geneva Convention of 1949, Article 118 of which stipulated, quote, "Prisoners of war shall be released and repatriated without delay immediately after the cessation of hostilities," end quote. Seeing as how both parties involved had already announced their intention to abide by the terms of the convention, the prisoner of war issue should have been easy to resolve. However, there were several figures in the UN camp who considered such an arrangement undesirable, seeing as how it had the potential to significantly alter the current balance of forces on the peninsula. Assistant Secretary of State Dean Rusk pointed out, quote, "The repatriation of all communist POWs would virtually restore intact to the North Koreans the number that they possessed at the time of the initial aggression," end quote. As long as there remained a possibility of the conflict restarting, Rusk and others wanted to limit the repatriation efforts, or at the very least to delay them, in order to forestall the rebuilding of the North Korean army. Ridgway proposed carrying out an exchange of prisoners on a one-for-one basis, to be followed by the repatriation of all remaining communist prisoners after all UN personnel had been returned. Another suggestion was to reclassify approximately 40,000 UN prisoners, ROK citizens who had been pressed into North Korean service, as civilian internees. Both of these proposals were seen as half-measures, but the constraints imposed by the Geneva Convention limited the UNC's options. One potential solution that was proposed at this time was to allow the prisoners themselves to choose which country they wanted to be sent to after the war. Strategically thinking, this principle of voluntary repatriation had some merit. It was suspected that a significant number of the UNC's prisoners actually held anti-communist beliefs, perhaps 50% by some estimates. This included not only the aforementioned 40,000 South Korean prisoners, but also a sizable proportion of Chinese POWs who were former nationalist soldiers. By allowing these prisoners to choose the country that they wished to be returned to, the authorities could distinguish between them and the genuinely committed communists. Adopting a plan of voluntary repatriation might have the additional effect of inducing disaffected communist soldiers to willingly surrender to the UN. Secretary of State Dean Acheson acknowledged that while the plan did possess some strategic and psychological value, he did not think that it could be legally implemented. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Omar Bradley also disapproved of the plan. He thought that pushing for voluntary repatriation would set a precedent that might allow hostile powers to continue detaining U.S. or allied prisoners indefinitely. In general, most American military leadership was of the opinion that they should push to get all of their personnel returned as quickly as possible, even if it meant an unequal exchange of prisoners with the enemy. The idea may have been abandoned for good had President Truman himself not taken such a keen interest in the issue. He was swayed by the moral arguments in favor of voluntary repatriation, most of which hinged on the assumption that the prisoners repatriated to the communists were likely to face severe punishment upon their return. The president, who had generally refrained from weighing in on the armistice negotiations, became an outspoken proponent of voluntary repatriation over the objections of his advisors. At his insistence, the State Department instructed Ridgway to seek a one-for-one exchange of prisoners, while also making, quote, a strong effort to avoid the forcible return to the communists of persons whose lives would be endangered thereby, end quote. The State Department memo acknowledged the likelihood that the communists would not accept the proposal, but that the UN delegation should, quote, stick to this position for as long as possible, without precipitating a break in the negotiations, end quote. POW rosters were exchanged in mid-December, but this only further complicated the issue. The roster provided by the communists listed only about 11,600 names. Of these, 7,000 were South Koreans, and the remaining 4,600 were UNC, American, British, Canadian, etc. There was a significant discrepancy between these numbers and the 88,000 personnel the ROK had identified as missing in action, and the 12,000 UNC personnel also listed as such. The communists' roster also conflicted with statements issued by the North Korean government to its own media outlets, in which they claimed to have captured over 65,000 prisoners in the first month of the war alone. That said, the communists also had cause for complaint, as they claimed 188,000 missing personnel, while the UN's roster only listed 132,000 prisoners. As both sides argued back and forth about relatively minor details regarding how certain prisoners should be classified, it became apparent that given the sheer size of the disparity between the numbers of prisoners held by the two different factions, the communists were almost certain to insist on an all-for-all exchange. The UN delegation first put the notion of voluntary repatriation on the table on January 2, 1952. The communists, who had not anticipated a proposal of this nature, responded with vitriol. Major General Yi Song-cho, a member of the communist delegation, denounced it as, quote, a barbarous formula and a shameful design which we absolutely cannot accept, end quote. Chinese state media described the proposal in similar terms and accused the UNC of, quote, bluntly violating the regulations of the Geneva Joint Pledge on POWs' rights, end quote. The UN delegation tried for several weeks to argue their position to no avail, leading Joy to conclude that, quote, the commies will never give up in their determination to bring about the unconditional release and repatriation of all of their POWs, end quote. As the negotiations ground to a halt once more, several influential figures in the American government and military declared their unequivocal opposition to the principle of voluntary repatriation. They said that there was no sense in continuing to push for a proposal the communists would never accept. Admiral Joy went even further, arguing that the policy was unethical on the basis that, quote, it places the welfare of ex-communist soldiers above that of our own United Nations Command personnel currently suffering in communist prison camps, end quote. President Truman, who had the support of Acheson and the State Department on this matter, remained firm. An entry in his private journal, dated January 27th, shows the extent of his frustration with what he saw as the communists' obstruction of the peace process. Quote, dealing with communist governments is like an honest man trying to deal with the king of a numbers racket or the head of a dope ring. They have no sense of honor and no moral code. the appropriate course of action at this time would be to give an ultimatum with a 10-day expiration limit, informing Moscow that we intend to blockade the Chinese coast from Korea to Indochina, to destroy every military base in Manchuria, and if there's further interference, we shall destroy any ports or cities as necessary to accomplish our peaceful purposes. End quote. As far as we know, the president never gave voice to these thoughts to any of his advisors, whose task now that it was becoming evident that the success of the negotiations hinged fully on the POW issue was to define the United States' official stance on the question. On January 22nd, the Assistant Secretary for the Far East, U. Alexis Johnson, established a working group within the State Department to, quote, explore how communist agreement to voluntary repatriation might be obtained, end quote. The group's findings were not entirely optimistic. Public opinion polls suggested that Americans supported voluntary repatriation in principle, but this support was conditional. Quote, if a break in talks occurred over the issue and if casualties continued to mount while UNC prisoners suffered in communist captivity, controversy would surely arise of the administration's commitment to the plan. End quote. Likewise, some of America's key allies, such as the UK, Canada, and Australia, had indicated their support for voluntary repatriation, but likely would not maintain this support if the issue became the sole remaining obstacle to a peace agreement. Moreover, further concerns were raised about the practicality of implementing such a plan. Simply put, the US government had no real idea of how many prisoners desired repatriation and how many did not. The only real way to get accurate numbers in this regard was to screen the prisoners, but the UNC's capacity to carry out such a screening appeared doubtful. An investigation into conditions at the primary UN POW camp on the island of Gyoje off of Korea's southern coast showed clearly that the UNC was struggling to manage the large number of prisoners in their custody, and that their ability to assert any control over the internal affairs of the camp was more or less non-existent. The prisoners, both Chinese and Korean, had divided into opposing factions based on their ideological affiliation, and violence between these groups became commonplace. The camp authorities, who relied on anti-communist prisoners to manage the day-to-day operations in the compounds, only made the political divisions between the prisoners more pronounced. We will explore this topic in greater depth in the next episode, but for the time being I will say that, in these conditions, screening the prisoners in the Gyoje camp would be a difficult task, if not impossible. All that being said, however, the group did conclude that the legal situation was not actually as unfavorable as initially thought. They pointed out that while the U.S. had indeed signed the Geneva Convention of 1949 and declared its intention to abide by its terms, they had yet to ratify it, and in fact would not do so until 1955. They concluded on that basis that the United States' adherence to the convention was, quote, unilateral and self-imposed rather than contractual, end quote. On February 8th, the Secretary of State presented Truman with a memorandum based on the findings of the working group. It read in part, quote, "It is therefore recommended that you approve the maintenance of the present U.S. position, namely that we will not accept communist proposals that require the use of force to repatriate communist prisoners of war held by the United Nations command," end quote. Truman signed off on this and put the policy into place immediately. Now that the United States' position on the issue had been officially defined, the next challenge was to get the communists to agree. Among the conclusions of the State Department's working group was that the root of the issue was, as Deputy Secretary Johnson put it, quote, "the numbers and nationalities of the POWs returned rather than the principles involved," end quote. If it could be determined that a critical mass of the POWs in UN custody would indicate their desire to be repatriated, the communists may be persuaded to carry out a POW exchange on a voluntary basis. Initial estimates suggested that of the 132,000 prisoners officially in UN custody, only 16,000, about 12%, would choose not to be repatriated. When these figures were told to the communist delegation at Panmunjom in early April, they were uncharacteristically accommodating, suggesting only that the matter be tabled until the exact numbers were determined. To this end, the UN, with communist approval, conducted a screening of their prisoners to determine exactly how many would opt for repatriation. The results of the screening were unexpected, to say the very least. They revealed that only 70,000 of the 132,000 prisoners, that is to say 53%, expressed a desire to return home. This was despite the fact that the UNC had actively tried to skew the results in favor of repatriation. With the proportion of non-repatriates so large, the prospect of the communists accepting their proposal became ever more distant. When the communist delegation at Panmunjom was told about the results of the screening, they were rendered temporarily speechless. When the initial shock wore off, they refused to accept the results of the screening as legitimate and would not use the figures provided as the basis for any further negotiations. This was not a purely cynical statement on their part either. State Department officials, as mentioned earlier, had expressed concerns that the conditions of the UN prison camp on Kyojedo precluded the possibility of carrying out a completely fair and impartial screening. In the hopes of keeping the talks going, the UN offered to release the 70,000 prisoners into communist custody immediately. When this was rejected, they proposed re-screening the prisoners, potentially even under the supervision of an international body of neutral countries. This, too, was rejected. As April 1952 gave way to May, it was becoming apparent that the negotiations were bound to reach yet another impasse. In Ghost Flames, Hanley gives a portrait of the talks as they stood circa June 1952, quote, "At the desolate tent village of Panmunjom, the armistice negotiations are nearly a year old, lasting longer than anyone anticipated when they first were convened. The two sides remain deadlocked over a single issue, the question of prisoner repatriation. The Americans say that their position, that under a truce, Chinese and North Korean POWs were to be given a choice to return to their homelands, is solid, final, and unchangeable. The communists countered that voluntary repatriation would flout the Geneva Conventions and amount to forceful retention. To Chi Chaochu, the Chinese interpreter, the process is degenerated into a charade. The sessions grow shorter, the recesses grow longer. Some of the most heated arguments are over the schedule and not of substance. Loud, vituperative voices fill the truce tent, and yet, one day, Chi had to remain frozen in his chair as the delegates faced each other stonily across the negotiating table in total silence for half an hour. Wary of the tedium, Chi and the other interpreters decided one day to spice up their language. Liar and lying have lost their punch. Poring over an English dictionary, they hit the word perfidy, explaining to the Chinese delegates that it means treachery or bad faith. One day, a delegate tried it out in English during a particularly tense session. The American across the table flew into a rage, demanding the statement be retracted. The Chinese stood his ground. "You are perfidious," he said. The red-faced American shot back. "And you were just a gang of common criminals," and stormed out the tent. End quote. On May 9th, an editorial by Chai Cheng-wen was published in People's Daily. In it, Chai, a staff member of the communist delegation, accused the UN of cynically hiding their intentions behind a veil of humanitarian concern. Quote, "They said that releasing all the prisoners would mean the enhancement of our military manpower. Our answer is that the Americans' argument showed that what they were really concerned with was not the prisoners' rights and happiness, but competition and combat forces and military power." End quote. In discussing his motive for writing this piece, Chai stated that he and the other members of the communist delegation, quote, "believed that world opinion needed to closely follow what was going on at the negotiations. The people who wanted an end to this war should know where the obstacles truly lay," end quote. Nonetheless, Chai's editorial doesn't really explain why the communists were so virulently opposed to the UN stance on the POW issue. In his 1995 book, The Korean War and International History, author William Stuick argues that for the Chinese and North Koreans, the issue boiled down to a question of legitimacy. With the civil war in China still in very recent memory, the communist leadership remained highly cognizant of the still ongoing battle for the hearts and minds of the Chinese people. They were also aware that Chiang Kai-shek had not yet given up his ambitions to retake the mainland with the help of his American benefactors. As Stuick posits, quote, "To accept no forced repatriation, the People's Republic of China would have to acknowledge a choice between itself and the despised and still dangerous nationalist government on Taiwan," end quote. North Korea was in a similar situation in this regard. This was even acknowledged in the report of the State Department's working group in February, quote, "To deny Korean prisoners protection from the only government which we recognize as legitimate, and to recognize as superior a claim put forth by a regime that we do not recognize as legitimate, would wash out the premises of our whole action in Korea. This issue gets at the heart of the contention between communism and the tradition that we live by. It bears on the natural rights of men to make choices and to claim protection," end quote. Despite the language of universalism employed here, the report ultimately recommended that the Korean and Chinese POWs be dealt with on a separate basis, seeing as how, quote, "the United States is not in Korea to protect a Chinese regime or to protect Chinese," end quote. Coincidentally, the Chinese delegates at Panmunjom had a similar outlook as they hinted at their willingness to make some concessions regarding Korean POWs. North Korea's status as a junior partner in the Communist Coalition meant that they were in no position to protest if the terms of an armistice agreement were not necessarily the most advantageous for them. On the opposite end of the table, the UN very much felt that they had backed themselves into a corner. In March, President Truman announced that, quote, the final U.S. position will be against forced repatriation, end quote. In other words, the United States would strictly adhere to their principles on this issue. They would seek no compromise. The president's advisors noted Truman's resolute refusal to re-examine his position. For whatever it's worth, Truman's rather strong feelings on the matter seem to have been genuine, as some of his candid remarks, such as, quote, I don't like the idea of sending these poor devils to their deaths, end quote, suggest. That said, there also happen to be ideological and geopolitical considerations at play. Acheson especially had come around to the idea that championing the cause of voluntary repatriation would play to the United States' advantage in the Cold War more broadly, as he wrote in his February 8th memorandum to the president, quote, any agreement which would require United States troops to use force to turn over to the communists prisoners who believe they would face death if returned would be most repugnant to our fundamental moral and humanitarian principles on the importance of the individual and seriously jeopardize the psychological warfare position of the United States in its opposition to communist tyranny, end quote. The events of April only served to reinforce these notions. Now that a screening had been conducted, however flawed the process may have been, there was now a widespread sentiment in the UN camp that they were honor-bound to not forcibly return so many individuals who had so willingly and openly identified themselves as anti-communists into communist custody. Anyway, I'll end the narrative for the time being here, in May 1952, with neither side willing to back down from their position on the POW issue, or willing to undertake any drastic military action, the prospect of bringing the war in Korea to a close seeming ever more remote by the day. In the next episode, we'll make a diversion from the main narrative to discuss the actual experiences of the prisoners whose fates were being weighed at Panmunjom. Then, in the 11th and final episode of the series, we will pick up with the story right where we left off. Hopefully, we'll be able to cover the final months of the war, the conclusion of the peace process, and the implementation of the armistice, to be followed by a prolonged reflection on the events of the war more generally, and how this conflict continued to affect the world in the decades that proceeded from it. But again, you'll have to tune in next time to hear all of this. In the meantime, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please send them to me via email at perspectivesinhistorypod@gmail.com. As I said at the top of the episode, I would like to hear from listeners as to whether or not I should go ahead and start publishing the next series of episodes while I'm working to finish up this series. I'm already inclined to do it, so that is the plan, unless I see any strong objections. Again, though, feel free to let me know your thoughts. If you like the show and want to help support it, you can do so either by becoming a supporter on Patreon or purchasing some old books from me on eBay. Links to both of these sites will be in the episode description, as usual. In any event, this has been the Perspectives in History podcast. Thank you very much for listening, as always. I'm your host, Willem Connor, signing off.